Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. This morning, I thought we'd spend a little time talking about what's going on in Syria, since that's still brewing. I guess Assad has committed the unforgivable sin for the West. He killed a reporter yesterday, and it's going to be interesting to see what the reaction of Western media is. But he has upped the ante on things, correct, Jim?
Yeah. The problem Syria has is that the government is toast. I mean, everybody is telling Assad that his family's, you know, rule is going, you know, it's just a matter of when. And the longer, I mean, this is what the diplomats are telling him, or his people, the longer he drags this out, the worse it's going to be for him. Now, he may believe that there's so much blood on the sides, on his sides, that, you know, it doesn't make any difference. Plus, he's probably got guarantees that he can, you know, depart for Iran. And the Iranians have undoubtedly told him that losing control of Syria would be a big loss for them. They will take him in and what have you, but he will no longer be running a country. I mean, that's something you really, it really hurts when you lose something like that. You know, being a LFA, you know, it's the thing dictators miss most, the power. Life's just not the same. But he's got a lot of followers, the Alawites, you know, talking about, he's got about 10% of the population who are still loyal to him, but even they are starting to reconsider. A lot of the non-Sunni, you know, group, the minorities, as it were, who've been running the country for the last 40 or so years, they are switching sides. They are trying to make peace. A lot of them don't have blood on their hands, although they've lived off, you know, the patronage of the Assad family. A lot of them are business people. A lot of them are simply, you know, people in towns that have got a lot of businesses which are favored by the Assads. Yeah, there's a lot of people who can be considered, you know, Quislings, collaborators, etc. But the ones who are truly in danger are the ones who gave the orders or who did the shooting. I mean, there's a lot of secret police and other types around who are definitely developing an exit plan. And Assad knows this. And, you know, even a lot of, I imagine, we may never know depending on what the body count is among his inner circle when this is all over. But I would imagine, you know, I mean, he's supposed to be a fairly open guy. But some of them are telling him maybe one-on-one. They say, look, Bashir, you know, this, you know, we got to get out of here. But he's caught between his rebellious population and the Iranians. Because basically the Iranians have kept the Assads, propped up the Assads, for 30 years now. If it hadn't been for the Iranians, Syria would be another province of Iraq. Because there's that split between the Ba'ath Party, which was originally, you know, gosh, originally all over the Arab world, but, its core was Iraq and Syria. When they split, it was a very bitter split, and if Saddam hadn't gone into Iran, he would have gone into Syria. But you know, Iran has oil and Syria doesn't, and that probably had a lot to do with it. But the Assads are apparently, you know, confident that they can push this far, a long way, in the hopes that they'll eventually, you know, basically subdue the uprising, bring a form of martial law, as it were, to the country, and not have to worry about, you know, another Libya, because they have strong backers. They have Iran, and of course they have Hezbollah, right across the border in Lebanon. But, you know, it's a matter of time. You know, I mean, again, foreign diplomats have been telling him, You know, it's not if, it's when, you know, it's not when, it's not, you know, whether or not it's going to happen, it's when it's going to happen. And he's just making more enemies, but apparently he doesn't care. But he figures, hey, everybody hates me anyway. So what difference does it make? I got a chance to remain, you know, the ruler of Syria, which he considers, you know, a family property. So he's doing it for all sorts of personal reasons, plus the fact that, if he gives in, Syria, you know, Iran cuts him loose, or maybe not, but I mean, you know, if he sticks it out, Iran says, hey, look, we take care of our own. But if he just, you know, surrenders to the West, you know, with war crimes, trials, and all this and that and what have you, so, you know, he's got, you know, it comes back to the old argument of whether or not dictators should be allowed to retire peaceably from the, you know, the stage. Because when you give them no way out, you simply, you know, get more people killed. You know, even Sun Tzu, you know, said that. Always, if you want to avoid a fight, give your enemy an exit. Don't trap him. You know, trapped animals, you know, fight the fiercest. And we're seeing another example of this here. Now, for all we know, there may be secret diplomacy going on, trying to arrange. But we know publicly the media, you know, takes its, gets on its high horse and says, no, 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 no. We must be perfect. No, no, you know, zero, you know, allowances, you know, for dictators. They must suffer. And of course, all the Syrians who got killed along the way must suffer as well. So it looks like it's going to be a fight to the finish, and who knows when that's going to be.
Wow. Austin?
Well, look, Dan, I'm thinking back to some earlier strategy talk discussions about Syria, and I think I just want to pick up on a couple of things we talked about, you know, several months ago. I still think they're relevant, and they actually dovetail with several things that Jim said. Look, I think the Assads thought they were going to crush this, the pizza pie rebellion early on when it broke out. Now, what, it was 11 months ago? Basically, when I say the pizza pie rebellion, is that you had all of these, essentially it was a rebellion of neighborhoods. Because Syria, it goes directly to the demographics in Syria, the range of ethnic communities, sectarian communities, and even how even though the big divide, you know, it's predominantly Sunni Muslim, there's still factions within factions there. But what you have is an expression of deep resentment. Dislike for the Assad regime and its corruption. It's not all as the Assads painted. They painted it one time that it was Sunni terrorists, and they painted it another time that it was foreigners. Of course, the Israelis, maybe the Turks, the Americans, the French. Well, the French are a favorite target as well, spurring all of these groups, including the Kurds, to rebel against the dictatorship. And would that go on? Yes, but was that the cause? No, it was just too widespread. It was, here's the opportunity to get rid of this evil dictatorship. And they haven't been able to do it. That is the fact that has led the diplomats, as Jim was mentioning, to put pressure on the Assads and tell them, you know, it's over, you've got to leave. In other words, the big fact on the ground is that the ground remains on fire. It may be little fires in little neighborhoods, but the Syrian regime, with the help of Iran, has not been able to stop it. Now, we're approaching a point, I mean, I think Jim's laid out the case for Assad leaving, what his options are. Yeah, I think Iran is logical. You see, on some websites, there's actually, I read a couple of fairly good discussions about this that aren't all hype and fear about it, is that you may see some of the Shias, some of the Alawi community, move to Iraq, it's a possibility. It's a possibility. But then remember that there are Shia rebels of various types as well against the Assad. So I mean, reason I'm mentioning that is that I've seen that discussion crop up on the internet. What happens if the Assads leave to the Alawi community? But that said, they have yet to give any indication that I'm aware of that. I'm talking about the Assad regime, that they're not going to continue the fight. So we're approaching a point where the question of do you arm the Free Syrian Army, the FSA? We had a couple of U.S. Senators, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, say earlier this week, 3 or 4 days ago, that they can support supplying arms. And this Graham flat out said included weapons. And it, even though the one of the articles I read after the statement was touted on the by the news media that it's, well, there should be other ways other than direct U.S. Support to supply those arms. But what we're really saying is that those, the pre-Syrian army and the rebels deserve financial support, material support to include weapons and ammunition, because they have been successful. Rebels have maintained their revolt now for almost a year, and the killing continues, directed by the Assad regime with the help of the Iranians. So we've got a moral and then the duty to support the rebels. And if we do it, it would be in our political interest as well. Now, that's a huge, huge commitment. But all I'm saying is we're coming up to that point, the fact that a couple of senators are talking about it, and it's no longer something that's being tossed around on the diplomacy blogs or on the mill blogs or the like, where that question arose 8-9 months ago. It's come to a point that there's going to be a, if it's not said out loud in Washington, it may be said or will be said in behind closed doors in European Union countries, NATO countries, including Turkey and the United States. Now, what does that mean? At one level, if it's actually done, and the Assads and the Iranians see that as, you could read that as, uh-oh, they're really getting close. The Turks are coming across the border. That would be the next move. We have to make the deal, and the Assads bug out. In other words, I painted that there as a political act, diplomatic pressure. But if you end up doing it, now you've got the recipe for the extended fragmenting war that where Syria falls apart into a collection of neighborhoods, something potentially reminiscent of what Lebanon was, and Syria's in some ways a big Lebanon. That's not something that Turkey wants. That's not something that Israel wants, to put the other regional power into play. Iran would lose the control it has. The utility of the current Syrian regime, because that's the way that they can supply Hezbollah and cause trouble within Lebanon. They might be able to adapt and even find that situation preferable to to the total loss of the Assad regime, because they'll always find somebody in there they can send weapons and money to. But you have a huge problem. If you thought the violence in Iraq was bad, this would be the violence in Iraq without a mediating American presence. So just some thoughts that that's the choice time's coming up. Don't know when it's when, but we're closer to it than we were. And if the Assad stay, you'll see may well see weapons supplied by quote unquote some source. I think it would be European NATO sources to the Free Syrian Army. And then after that, if they don't win and force the Assad's out, we've got a new Lebanon.
What are some of the different factions that are on the opposite side of Assad?
Well, mainly it's Sunnis versus everybody else. The Sunnis are about 80%, 75% of the population. You got Alawites and a bunch of Christians and Druze, and the usual suspects when it comes to minorities in the Middle East. The Alawites are often described as Shia, but they're not quite Shia. They're basically Protestant Shia, is a description that Westerners will probably understand, but it's not entirely accurate. They're basically another religious sect, which share some beliefs and practices with the Shia. But basically, there's a lot of some Sunnis consider them just as heretical as the Druze, who are basically, again, generalizing, old school pagans, pretending to be Muslims. Again, that's not very generous. It's what a lot of Sunnis describe them as. But that's one reason why the Druze are drafted into the Israeli armies and no other Arabs are. Because the Jews know that the Druze are as hated, as Jews are by, most Muslims. It's mainly a economic dictatorship. The founder of the Bashar Assad's father, he was very shrewd. He was an army man, but he basically went around to all the business people, especially the ones he felt he could trust the most, mainly Alawites and Christians and what have you, and said, "Look, let's do business." And that's the way it's been for some 40 years. However, this only works if the government, the dictatorship, provides a good business climate for his friends. However, this means that most of the population is screwed. There's no opportunity unless you have an inside, with the Assads. You can't do anything. You have a great new idea, go to America or Europe, pal, because you're not going to get it done, in Syria, or at least not with any reward. You might get, kitchen scraps, but you're certainly not going to get what you could, if you basically took your energy or your idea or whatever and ran with it in the United States or, parts of Europe, where entrepreneurs are still, tolerated. And this is what most Syrians are upset about. When Arab Spring came along, they said, Syria was, has been a wealthy part of the world for a long, long time. It was much coveted by the Romans. Its loss, to the Muslims, hurt the Byzantines a lot. It's a valuable part of the world because of the people. And the people basically chose, surviving over, fighting for economic independence, and now a generation has come along and says, no, all right, we'll risk our lives, which they've been doing. Some 7,000 have died so far. We want our economic freedom and other freedoms. We just don't want to work, work and live in a police state with no opportunities. And of course, the opportunities have been diminishing since the Cold War ended because the Syrians have very little oil. They have some. They basically got a lot of subsidies from the Russians to be pro-Russian. But that disappeared 20 years ago. And then that's when the Iranians, stepped in. The Iranians stepped in while the Russians were still around. That was a golden time for Syria. The largesse has not been, that abundant, and people are just sick and tired of it. The same thing happened in Eastern Europe in the 1980s. people take it for, you know, a generation or two, and then, you know, one generation comes along and says, ah, no more. So, you know, it's not that, like, there are a lot of factions. I mean, the Sunnis are not united. There are political and religious factions. A lot of them are a matter of individual preference. There's not as much tribalism in Syria as there are in other parts of the Arab world, but tribal organizations do exist. There are Kurds, who are basically, you know, an ethnic tribe, as it were, but even they have little divisions within themselves. But the only thing that really unites the opposition is, you know, we want out. In fact, the Kurds are interesting because they're the one minority that were never in the inner circle. They were basically, you know, out there with the, although they are Sunni, they are, you know, the outsiders throughout the region. But they were outside everybody in Syria. And now the government has tried to, you know, play nice to the Kurds, but it's really not working. The Kurds are definitely with the, you know, the rebels. So it's basically 15% of the population versus 85%. And once the Assads are gone, then you'll see other, you know, coalitions arise, and you'll get the usual crazy quilt of competing, you know, interest groups, which you're seeing in Iraq. But that's preferable to just having one group grabbing all the goodies and pointing guns at anybody who disagrees. So that's the political layout in Syria.
Well, what do you think the end game is going to be in Syria, Jim, and we'll wrap it up there?
Well, Russia and China have prevented the UN from issuing any, you know, letter of marque, as it were, as they did in Libya, and giving the interested countries, which again includes the Arab League and a lot of NATO nations, to basically go in there with air power or what have you, and speed the process up. If you do it the slow way, more people are going to get killed. Although certainly, it's certainly not as bad as it was in Libya, where Gaddafi was using much more violence against, you know, essentially a smaller population. I mean, I haven't seen final numbers out of Libya, but apparently it's like 50,000, you know, dead. He was going pounding entire cities. I mean, he turned his artillery loose big time. In Syria, it's being done selectively. They're hitting particular neighborhoods. In fact, they've been sending the secret police in to do house-to-house searches in neighborhoods that, you know, the army has declared more or less clear. But there's more shooting going on. If you're working for the Assad government, you do not go unarmed anymore. You've got to assume that there may be somebody around the corner who's going to take a shot at you. But they do feel that they can go house-to-house, they can arrest key people, and that they can ultimately, you know, tamp it down, as it were. The fire's never going to go out, but they don't care. They just want to be back in control. Right now, they're not in control. So as long as the Iranians want to send, you know, $500 million a month, you know, into the country, so they can buy black market goods because they are under embargoes, it's going to go on, and it might go on for months, because the Syrian people, the rebels, simply haven't got the weapons. The army, although it's losing a lot of people to desertion, it's not losing a lot of weapons. This is something you don't read about, but, you know, a few choice emails can reveal all. And apparently what most of the Syrian army is doing is keeping their bases locked down. People can run away, although they're getting shot at if they're not careful. And they might take their, you know, their personal, you know, their assault rifle or pistol, you know, when they go. But some of them are so anxious to get out. They're not anxious to get out and join the Free Syrian Army. Most of the deserters just want to get away from the craziness. But he can't use a lot of those troops because mainly he's got the few ones who are loyal, keeping an eye on the ones who are not loyal, and making sure the weapons do not get out into the population. This limits the number of forces. He only has about maybe 100,000, you know, dependable troops, including armed secret police and what have you, that he can send around. So he cannot, you know, basically go around and kill a lot of people, and he's not interested. He knows a lot of people are just, you know, keeping their heads down. There are maybe a few thousand of these Free Syrian Army guys running around, but there are not going to be a lot more of them because they simply haven't got the weapons. Some weapons are coming across the border from Iraq, although the Iraqis have basically clamped down on the main road crossings, so it's more difficult. You got to get a mule or a horse or whatever, or a real cross-country vehicle, and go through the desert with the stuff. There's simply not a lot of weapons coming in. And as long as the Assad can keep that situation, they're not going to face a huge outgrowth of armed, angry rebels coming at them, which is what happened to Libya, because when Libya started losing control of military bases, he had a lot of weapons stored. Suddenly, you know, a lot more people were armed and angry. They may not have been trained, but they were angry. Syria, on the other hand, has conscription. Most young men go in, so they got a lot more people who know how to use weapons, who are accustomed to military procedures and what have you. You can whip them into shape, you know, in a couple of days. It all comes back to you. But they simply have no access to weapons. So unless this changes in a hurry, which is unlikely to do, he's simply going to keep, you know, going after what he considers the most dangerous concentrations of rebels. Try and knock them down. And like I say, Syria, Iran apparently is interested in just keeping this going. Is, you know, if the Assads are not willing to, you know, make a peace. So the end game, probably not more than a year, because I don't think the world is going to stand for it. The Turks in particular have said they're not happy with this, because as more people, more refugees pour into Syria and even Lebanon, you know, the Turks are stuck with taking care of them, and they don't like that. They much rather, you know, everybody in the neighborhood would much rather this be over. But somebody's got to do the heavy lifting. And again, Russia is not interested, in basically, you know, withdrawing their veto. China has changed its mind of late. They've been saying, well, maybe this isn't such a great idea. But, you know, the Russians have not even, you know, come out that much yet. So the end game could go on for months. There's no, I doubt very much if there's going to be a quick finish in this particular situation. It's not moving fast, and that means it's probably not going to end fast.
Well, I will be continuing to watch it here on Strategy Page, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's great for the journalists, not so great for the Syrians.
Right, not great at all for the Syrians. Well, we'll talk to you in Austin next time.
Bye.
Bye.